Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello everyone, and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. This week we have a real treat for you, particularly those of you interested in underwater heritage, the remains of human creation that lies on the seabed and makes a new life amongst the fish and the weed and the sea sponges. Now, there are few places finer on Earth to explore this type of maritime history and archaeology than the island of Malta. I've really enjoyed putting this episode together because on several occasions as a child, I visited Malta with my mum, dad and sister. And now I look back on it, I wonder if that was a key moment in my life when my love for history and the sea first came together. For the sea, well, I'm not sure there's anything quite like it in Malta, jumping in off warm rocks into deep, clear water. And the history of the island is completely astonishing. Malta lies in the Mediterranean between Sicily and the North African coast, which has made it a stepping stone for empires as they strode in giant leaps across the Mediterranean. It was important for the Romans, the Moors, the Knights of St. John, the French, and then the British. And that's just its recent history. Evidence of prehistory in Malta goes back at least 6,000 years. For an eight-year-old boy such as I was, it was the eye-catching castle of Valletta, which I think absorbed my attention, and the story of the great siege of Malta in 1565, when the entire might of the Ottoman Empire fell on this tiny island, then held by the Knights Hospitaller, whose headquarters had moved from Jerusalem after the First Crusade to Rhodes, and thence to Malta. The siege on Malta was the climax of a ferocious struggle for control of the Mediterranean between the military forces of Christianity and Islam, and the tiny force of knights there and its foot soldiers managed to hold off the masses of the Ottoman army. As maritime-based sieges go, it was one of the most extraordinary in history. And do you know what? I think we should dedicate at least some future episodes to Malta's siege and to similar maritime sieges. Anyway, what's interesting about Malta is that unless you know where to look, your eye is caught by the great battlements of the fortresses and the spires of the churches, the curious windows and balconies offering differing styles of architecture that was left behind as different civilizations settled and then moved on. There's so much to see for the land-based explorer, but what you're missing out on is astonishing, and it's all underwater. The collections of underwater heritage around Malta quite simply has to be one of the richest collections in the world, and the quality of preservation is also astounding, as well as the number of sites. And yet, they are all inaccessible to so many of us. Not only do you need to be able to dive to see these, but you need to be able to dive very, very deep. And that's only possible for a tiny fraction of the world's population. You have the requisite skill, experience, knowledge, equipment, support, and let's not forget courage. They really are quite dangerously deep, some of these sites. One man has decided that this is not acceptable. He is called Timmy Gambin, and his vision for making this deep underwater heritage accessible has now been realised in a virtual underwater museum. You can find it at underwatermalta.org. That's underwatermalta.org. And it's called the Virtual Museum Underwater Malta. This online platform brings underwater cultural heritage to the surface, into the homes of the general public. Using 3D, virtual reality and other media, the aim of the website is to provide access to and share Malta's unique underwater cultural heritage with all members of the public. Timmy Gambin is an associate professor in maritime archaeology at the Department of Classics and Archaeology at the University of Malta. He graduated in history from this university and went on to attain his master's in maritime archaeology and history from the University of Bristol, which incidentally is where I got my master's in maritime archaeology from. He also has a doctorate in maritime archaeology. Professor Gambin has been involved in numerous collaborative research projects around the world and has also co-directed numerous offshore underwater surveys in various parts of the Mediterranean. I think Timmy is an inspirational man. I hope you enjoy listening to his energy and fizzing ideas as much as I did. So here is Timmy and his fabulous underwater museum. Timmy, thanks so much for speaking to me today.
Sam, it's my pleasure.
Now, Timmy, I absolutely love Malta. I've got very fond memories of going there as a kid on my holidays. I was going to say, can you tell me about Malta's maritime history? But that's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? There's so much of it. Let me put it a different way. Have you got a favourite bit of Malta's maritime history?
Well, I think it's as much as a challenge as the first question. It's a bit like asking me, you know, who my favourite child is. I'm a big fan of all periods of our maritime history. I mean, if we just take the British side, you know, to think that Nelson sailed into our harbours, the British had their Mediterranean fleet based here. So there's a real connection, which is still very much alive to this day, between the Royal Navy and Britain on one side and Malta and the Maltese on the other.
Sure. I mean, if you just sort of think about the breadth of it, just for our listeners out there who may not know it, but there's Phoenician history, you've got a history from Carthage, the Romans, the Byzantines, the Arab rule from the mid-19th century, there was the Norman conquest, rather like Britain, you guys had a Norman conquest, the Knights Hospitaller for 2.5 centuries, the French occupation, you know, with Napoleon in 1798, and then, of course, the World Wars. I mean, I suppose out of all of that, my favourite thing must be the Great Siege of Malta, 1565, when you've got the Ottomans trying to conquer the island of Malta. I vividly remember walking around the battlements of Valletta and imagining it. I was quite into sieges and castles when I was a kid, and I ended up, you know, being a professional historian looking at it. So, yeah, that's I think the Great Siege is one of my favourite.
Absolutely. And one of the driving forces behind our work, looking at the maritime archaeology of Malta and Gozo, is we're surrounded with this condensed history. You know, wherever you look, you mentioned Valletta, but go to any village in the countryside and it's got a massive church, you know, filled with paintings from the Renaissance and so on. And this is all reflective of the connectivity of the island. So I always had a burning question as to whether this history is reflected on the seabed, whether we can have the same traces or traces of the same history on the seabed, because being an island, just like Britain, people had to come and go till the advent of air travel by sea.
Yeah. And there's so much of it there. We were talking about what you can see on land, the great churches and the castle at Valletta, whatever it might be. But the whole point about what you guys are doing with the virtual museum is that there's so much also on the seabed, and it's about providing access to people who may not be able to dive.
Absolutely. So we did find out that our history that is very much present on the seabed as much as it is on land. And Heritage Malta, which is the national agency for the management and conservation of heritage sites on the island, provides access to your traditional sites like the Roman villa, the temples, the world famous late Neolithic temple. So my concept was, why not provide access to our underwater heritage? You can go and visit a fortress, why not visit a warship? So Heritage Malta set up the Underwater Cultural Heritage Unit, which provides access. So a diver, local or visiting from overseas, can book via a registered dive school, and they can actually pay, buy a ticket, and visit the site itself. But most of our sites are beyond the 50-meter contour line. So that is really beyond traditional scuba depth. So the sites, although they are open, and that's sort of, you know, something we're very proud of, however, they're only open to a small percentage of the world's population. So the idea behind the museum was, now, what's the next step? How can we take these sites to the general public that cannot dive beyond 50 meters, which, as we both know, is the vast majority of the world's population.
Yeah, and so you've created it. We'll go on and talk about some of the examples in a moment. But my first question, I suppose, is how did you find the sites? Actually, there are two questions. One is, how did you find them? But were all of the sites that feature in your museum known to you when you began the project, or did you discover some in the process?
That's a very good question. Some were known. Like the Bowfighter, HMS Maori. Some were known and had been dived already. Others, such as the Phoenician shipwreck, the Sky Raider, these were discovered as part of a broader project. For over two decades now, myself and at the University of Malta, I've been conducting a sonar survey off the coast of Malta and Gozo. And quite literally, Sam, you know, we take our side scan sonar out and we map the seabed. So we're producing an image, an archaeological map of the seabed, and if it's there, if it's present on the seabed, we'll find it. So most of the sites were discovered by us. And that to me makes it more special, because we're bringing sites that are hitherto unknown to the general public.
So what's the process like? So say you find a site, something appears on the side scan sonar, and you go, well, this is interesting. What's the next stage of kind of investigating whether of how interesting it actually is, and if it's going to feature in your virtual museum?
Well, there are a number of ways that we classify sites. The site scan will give us an idea of how well preserved it is. So, you know, when you end up with a sonar image of a plane looking as though it's just landed on the seabed, then straight away, that's something that catches your eye, and if it's within the diveable depths of our team, we dive down to 130 meters. So anything down to 130 meters, we can investigate ourselves. Anything beyond that, we use a remote operated vehicle, which is a robot with a camera driven from the surface. So we decide, A, according to budget, B, according to sort of the level of interest, how much we can identify. Now, there are some which we deem not as exciting as others based on the sonar image. And lo and behold, you know, we're sometimes pleasantly surprised. So once we've decided which sites we're going to investigate, the first dive is generally dedicated to identification. So we dive, identify and confirm the type of plane it is, for example, or what ship it is. There is also background research, because we know what ships were lost in World War I and World War II. So most of them have been found, but there are still a handful out there that haven't been found. We have an approximate idea of where these are. So this background research is going on all the time. We confirm whether it's one of these. Then, on the basis of our first recon, we go to the next phase. And the next phase is starting to record the site in detail. One, to have a scientific yardstick. We want to know what the state of that site was in 2021, for example. And then any further studies can be measured against that that baseline. And two, the same data that we capture goes into the formation of a site on the museum.
Once you've decided to record, how do you actually go about it? Because for those of you who are listening, do please check out our Facebook site and the YouTube channel. We've got some truly wonderful 3D imagery of the, some of the sites that Timmy is talking about. How do you actually go about creating those wonderful images?
We have a we've developed a special technique to record sites in 3D. We use high-resolution photography, so two quite powerful cameras. The secret is the lighting. At those depths, there's hardly any lighting at all. Natural light doesn't penetrate down to 70, 80, 90 meters, so we've got very powerful bespoke lights. And our 3D experts swim and take a photograph every second so that there's enough overlap, and then once... Just to give you an idea, in a half-hour dive, these three, we call them the 3D fairies because they're always flying around the site taking this imagery. In a half-hour dive, they can shoot up to 4,000 photographs each. Then once we surface, we take those photographs, we process them through at least two specialized software suites. And generally, after the first dive, we've got an outline model. On the basis of that outline model, we can recognize where we need to go back to in order to fill in and bring the model up to up to a standard that for us is acceptable to put onto the museum.
I mean, just to give a sense of how many people are actually involved in this. So say you've got some people taking photographs of something the size of a World War II bomber. On the seabed. How big is the team enabling you to do that? Because you've got support boats. How many people are on the boat? How many people are in the water?
It's a nice bit of recognition for the people who are sort of behind the scenes. They're not behind the scenes for us because we see them as guardian angels. We've got the main dive boat, which has a skipper and two support divers. So once we come up from, let's say, a 100-meter dive, just to give your listeners a bit of background, to descend to 100 meters takes us 6 minutes. We've got approximately 14 minutes on the site. Then it takes us anything between 2 and 2.5 hours to ascend. We're full of extra cylinders for safety. We've got all the cameras, the scooters. So our two support divers dive down to about 24 meters and take all the gear that we don't need. So those are the three support members of the dive boat team. Will be probably, for a bomber, will be two teams of three. So there are six deep divers. And then there is the fast boat, which has a crew of one. And the fast boat is there just in case the team gets separated. So there's a whole safety protocol, which is, you know, we go through this and the briefing the evening before. And then we repeat the briefing on the boat as we're going up. So for a bomber, it's approximately 10 persons. And that's on the field. Obviously, then there are a whole host of other people working in the background with regard to graphics, processing, etc.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Yeah, it's so important. I mean, for all of you out there now, hopefully, who have just found some of these images, it's so easy in this day of absorbing imagery so quickly to kind of forget about how they're actually created. But let me tell you, the images from the seabed off Malta, it takes some serious doing. And it's one of the reasons I'm so impressed with what you guys have managed to achieve. Let's now have a quick chat about some of the sites. The Bristol Blenheim. So this is you've got the wreck of a British, it's a light bomber. By the end of 1940, you've got these aircraft. They're performing anti-shipping roles. They're bombing reconnaissance missions to support Allied ground troops in North Africa. They're all over the place, aren't they? And you found one of them.
yes, actually, the Blenheim bomber is one of the popular dive sites for those on scuba gear. So it's been known. But it's also a typical example, besides being an integral part of our history, you know, of Malta's history in World War II, which we'll come back to. It's also indicative of what a short time, Sam, we have with these wrecks. In particular, aircraft underwater and seawater do not go well together. Aircraft were made from a lot of experimental alloys, and once they come into contact with seawater, they sort of start eroding, then they reach a sweet spot where they kind of stabilize. But we're beginning to notice, especially in shallower waters where you have a combination of biological factors, things like light as well, the warmth, maybe even climate change is starting to impact these sites. But the Blenheim bomber is a clear example of how quickly a site can deteriorate. When we started diving this site a few years ago, it was practically intact. Today, it's just a skeleton.
Yeah. So and another thing to remember when you're looking at these images is that they're not going to be like that forever. The whole point of taking these wonderful 3D images is that there's a record of them for when they are no longer there. They can no longer be seen, dived on, or appreciated at all. So you're creating, you know, its own little moment in history. You're freeze framing it as it is on the seabed at the moment. And then how about another one? You've got the Junkers, the Ju-88, a German version, a German plane. Tell me about that one.
Well, the Second World War in Malta was mainly fought in the air, but and I'm not saying this because it's a Mariner's Mirror podcast, but the main reason that the Germans wanted to annihilate the island and as a base for the British was that it was a thorn in Rommel's side. From Malta, the fighting tenth, okay, the 10th submarine flotilla would sail out and literally decimate supply convoys to North Africa. So the only way that the Axis forces could respond, well, actually there were two ways. One was to try and bomb the hell out of the island, especially the harbour area. You mentioned Valletta before, you know, the population was forced to leave or go underground in rock-cut shelters. The main reason they were bombing Valletta was it was the bays for the British ships, but there were also the dockyards. So the dockyards were utilized to actually fix and repair ships such as the Illustrious that were damaged at sea. The second aspect that they wanted to get at is they wanted to stop the 10th flotilla. They wanted to stop the submarine. So what they did is the second way that they tried stopping the British using Malta as an effective attack base was to lay massive minefields. One of the sites we have on the museum is the Schnellboot, the German E-boat. This was actually part of a small flotilla. They were laying mines outside the harbour, and it struck one of its own mines and sunk. So when you see the proximity of the Schnellboot to the harbour, the Germans were getting within under a mile of the coast. That's the risks. That's reflective of the risks they were willing to take in order to sort of disable Malta as a fighting force. Some of the sites that are coming up on the museum, for example, HMS Olympus, a famous submarine we discovered some years ago, was sunk by a mine laid by the Germans and the Italians. So their minefields were indeed effective, Sam.
Yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it? One of the things we started off there talking about the German bomber, in comparison with the Bristol Blenheim, this JU-88 is in magnificent condition, isn't it? Just sort of sitting.
Yes, I changed tack a bit. So the JU-88 was the main bomber used by the Germans in the war, and it was one of the main bombers used to fly out of Sicily to attack Malta, to carry out these attacks on the dockyard, the airfields, and so on. There are a number of JU-88s that were shot down into the sea. We have two already on the museum. One of them, the one that you're referring to, is in absolute pristine condition. The cockpit is still intact. The forward-looking gun is still intact. There's a reason why the JU-88 at the south of the island is in such perfect condition. This is deeper than the Blenheim, and light is cut out. So the less light there is, the more the less growth there is. So the less biological impact. The sea is colder. The temperature is more stable. Therefore, the conditions are conducive to better preservation. And I must say, the pilot must have made a fantastic ditching into the sea, because you cannot have such a well-preserved plane if this crashed at terminal velocity, for example.
Yeah, it seems to have just settled down. Isn't that the one that's missing the rescue dinghy on the back? Is that right?
Yes. So for your listeners, if they go on the site, there's a rectangular space towards the tail, and that's where the rescue dinghy used to be. So this is indicative that the crew survived, that they got into the dinghy, and we're still trying to research which actual plane this one is. As I said, that so many JU-88s got shot down, but the RAF ran a fantastic air sea rescue. I must say, there's an excellent book called Call Out, which is a transcription, a day-to-day diary of these three motor launches that literally, Sam, risked life and limb to go out and rescue pilots, not only British, American, Canadian, but also German and Italians. And they did a fantastic job of going out and rescuing pilots in the central Mediterranean. So we're trying to match the JU-88 that we discovered in 108 meters or so with one of the rescues by the RAF fast launch.
Wonderful. It's a great story. And each one's a little kind of a microcosm of history, which you can unravel. What about this X lighter? You've got an X lighter. What's that?
Well, the Exeliter is, again, a very popular site, dive site, especially when the northwest blows, because she's in situ. The Exeliter is a like a bunkering barge, and the one that is sunk off Manuel Island in Malta is reputed to have taken part in the Gallipoli campaign.
Okay, so this is something that was built for the First World War, but then repurposed for the Second.
Absolutely. So already in World War II, she comes with a baggage of history. She's already sort of has historic importance because she's used in the Gallipoli campaign. Now, quite clearly, you know, when you're in desperate need of equipment, nobody's going to say, "Oh no, we'll preserve this Exeliter because she took part in Gallipoli." And she was she was used as a bunkering barge at the submarine base off Manuel Island. In the beginning, the German planes didn't know where the submarines were based, because every time there was an air raid, the submarines would settle on the seabed. If I take a step back, the British had started excavating submarine pens in the 1930s, but they were deemed too expensive, and the British Parliament sort of cut the budget and stopped them. So anyway, the submarines used to sink, used to go down to the bottom and evade detection. Eventually, the German planes found out what was happening, and so they would come in, dive, and bomb the base of the submarine flotilla. There were two casualties, two submarines sunk in the harbour, one of which was brought up and cut up and scuttled outside. Another one was brought up whole and then scuttled outside Malta to train ASDIC operators. The Exeliter was the victim of one bombing raid. If you visit the virtual museum underwater Malta, you get a very good idea of the shape and type of barge it is. Incidentally, even if you dive it, it's only in 15, 20 meters of water, but you never see it in its entirety because the water is pretty murky in the harbor. So this is also an opportunity for people who have dived it or who are going to dive it to visualize it in its entirety. But once you open up the 3D model on the side, there is a very, very clear marking of a bomb that penetrated its side. And that bomb went right through that barge and sunk it on the spot.
Yeah, I was my mouth was wide open when I actually looked at that. You know, I've seen quite a few images of wrecks, but it's very, very powerful, just to give you an impression of the sheer ferocity of what you know, the explosion that sank that vessel. I also love this idea of, you know, all of these wrecks from a similar period, just sort of lying around in the landscape. And if you answer the question, why does underwater cultural heritage matter? If you just imagined, if I don't know, in the deserts of North Africa, if all of Rommel's tanks were still there, how important that would be, or on the beaches of Normandy, and in some places underwater, it's just lying there, waiting to be discovered, waiting to be seen. And that's why I think you're doing such a wonderful job. Why, if you could sum it up, why do you think underwater cultural heritage matters?
Well, it matters on various levels, and I'll give you a very current and very real example. In May 2019, my team were involved in the discovery of HMS Urge, a British submarine from the 10th Flotilla. The 10th Flotilla was asked to leave Malta because it was deemed too dangerous and to go to Alexandria, and the HMS Urge never made it. She was presumed lost in action, which she was. Now, some years ago, I was contacted by the grandson of Commander Tomkinson, who was lost with all hands on deck. There were 28 crew and 10 guests, including a very well-known journalist. To cut a long story short, we deployed our sonar, and after a number of days, discovered her lying off the seabed off Malta. So like the Olympus, she struck a mine, sunk to the seabed, never to be seen again until May 2009. We've remained in the grandson of Commander Tomkinson. His mother is still alive, so the daughter of the commander, who was just a few months old, okay, when her father went down with the mother's love letters on board, some keepsakes and so on, is actually still alive. And one of the first things that the grandson did was he went back to his mother to show her images of her father's wreck. Now, like Commander Tomkinson, as I said, there were 37 others. So over the years, the 37, you know, multiplies into quite a large number of relatives and so on. And it is absolutely incredible the importance with which these relatives deem this discovery. And we hope that they will come to Malta in April, COVID permitting, in April 2022, Sam, which is the 80th anniversary of the Urges sinking. And we plan some big dives in order to place a commemorative plaque. And the family will be unveiling a memorial to these 38 persons at Fort St. Elmo. Now, I know it's a bit of a long-winded answer, but if that doesn't show the importance of underwater cultural heritage, then I don't know. I mean, I can talk about ancient trade and what shipwrecks have taught us about that, but when you actually have such a tangible human story, I think it makes it all worthwhile.
That's a wonderful answer, wonderful answer. So where are we with the virtual museum? I mean, are there more wrecks going to be posted up there as you go along?
At the moment, there are 14 sites, just like a real museum. This is a real museum. It's just yeah, placed it is, in a absolutely. Virtual world, because you can't pick up the shipwrecks and place them in a building. You wouldn't want to do that anyway. So just like any other museum, the collection is not a dead and static collection. We have 14 sites currently online. As we speak, my team are working on putting another 3 sites online. That will take it up to 17. Within the next 2-3 years, depending on the funding levels that we're able to maintain, we have at least up to 40 sites, and that is excluding anything else that we discover in the coming years, because we're deploying our sonar every year for a number of weeks. So up to 40 sites. This is important because it will keep our clients, so to speak — they're not, because the museum is free — but it will keep our visitors coming back to the site, because there's always going to be something new.
Yeah. It's brilliant. It's really fantastic. It's one of the best examples of using modern technology to bring the maritime past closer to as many people as possible that I've ever come across. And I heartily congratulate you.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Everyone who's listening, please go and check out. And Timmy, what's the address?
It's a virtual museum. It's underwatermalta.org. Very simple. Underwatermalta.org.
Well, I'm sure we're going to be coming back, because you've teased me about Malta's ship graffiti, and I'm determined to come out there with a video camera and get some of it. So I'll be back to speak to you again soon, Tim. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Do please follow us wherever you engage on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram or YouTube. In particular, do check out what we've got on YouTube. I'll make sure that there's footage from the Underwater Museum there for you to check out. For those of you listening on an iPhone, please make sure you take a few moments to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Best of all, please join the Society for Nautical Research at snr.org.uk. It really doesn't cost very much, but it does a huge amount of good. It supports this podcast. You get 4 printed journals a year. You can sign up to come to our annual dinner on board HMS Victory. It supports all of the worthwhile goodness that the Society does to publish the world's most important maritime history and to preserve our maritime past.